Welcome back to Shatteremus. We have Kirk with us. We are discussing the preamble to one of the more interesting prophecies in the most interesting book of prophecy, Yeshayah. This is one that begins, as so many do, with the word woe. When you hear the word woe, which is oi in Hebrew, what comes to mind, Kirk?
Be alert. This is the bad news.
Right. So this is something I'm going to tell you that is something you should be very concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're reading a woe, you ought not think necessarily that God is going to perpetrate some judgment, but instead that he is presenting a scenario, presenting something that's going to transpire in human history.
Right.
That's going to be really bad. And that you ought to be aware of that so you aren't blindsided by it, so you don't become part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
They always warn you.
So the whole purpose of a woe is this is a warning so that you are not blindsided by or susceptible to something that's going to happen in human history that is horrible.
Right.
And we've discovered a number of woes. Most every time, if not every time, the woe is not followed by something that God is doing that's judgmental.
No, it's us walking away into, and we kind of sit and walk into our own traps most of the time.
Yeah, he's usually speaking of something that humans collectively, through religion or politics, the big human institutions or militarily, something that humans have done in a broad way, in a big way, in a massive way, in a popular way, that is counterproductive, deadly, deceitful, destructive. In fact, almost always. And we should, immediately as we hear, oi, woe, we should be attuned to, there's something that God is telling us about that's going to grow out of a combination of religion, politics, nationalism, militarism, that is going to be very broad-based and extraordinarily destructive.
Mm-hmm. Trouble ahead.
Trouble ahead, and we're not talking about, Yahweh spends a lot less time talking about individual issues, individual flaws. You know, Christianity is all caught up in and homosexuality and
performance.
Yeah, and fornication and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Individual sin. That's mm-hmm. That's just not Yahweh's perspective.
Now, he's not that away.
Yeah, it's a couple of times mentions homosexuality and say, you know, you ought not do that. But his issues are far more broad-based. So it's wholesale rebellion against him. It's religious rebellion and political rebellion and the kind of things that man institutes that affect millions, if not billions, of people, as opposed to individual flaws.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we're attuned to this woe, we should be attuned not to the Christian perspective of somebody is engaged in and sexual misconduct or homosexuality, but something on a massive scale. It doesn't make a prophetic utterance unless it is A, massive in scale, and B, extraordinarily caustic and destructive, counterproductive.
Yeah, very little you can do is going to pull down the nation.
Correct.
In your personal life of
correct. So God's not saying woe to Kirk for having drawn a solicitous picture of a naked lady. In fact, he probably is applauding it because who designed the naked form of the lady?
I think he did.
He did. So he's probably applauding it rather
admiring
than
his work is what I would be doing.
Yeah, that's exactly. You're admiring his work. He's just not into that. You know, he's the individual things that we do that may or may not be good or, who knows. But the fact is they're just not important. They don't make prophecy.
To prove your point a little bit, as far as I know, Dode is pretty big on admiring
the female form. Yeah. The female form? Yeah. Yes, he was.
And he had a lot of good things to say about Dode.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, so it underscores the point.
Despite all these things, that's not the big issue here.
Right. Right. So when you see the word woe, you ought not think about, you know, that so many preachers are saying, you know, America is corrupt. You know, we have homosexual marriage and we have this, that, and the other thing. No, that's just not, that does not merit a woe. And woe means declaring a warning regarding an extreme lack of understanding and the prevalence of delusion. Now, the things that are widespread, extreme as they relate to understanding and delusion, are societal, academic, political, or religious. Those are your options. So he's warning about those things. To the presumptive, arrogant, and conceited. Now, this would be, and these are adjectives, speaking of wreath and crown.
Mm-hmm.
So,
leadership.
Yeah, leadership. You don't very often get leadership, at least apart from business leadership that isn't egotistical. Now, in large corporations, my guess is that business leadership, too, has a conceited aura to it. But for the most part, the conceit that you see in leadership is the conceit that you would see at the very top of a network news, for example. You would see it, politics is the arena of the personal ego. So they're all arrogant. And you can see how they presume that they have special rights because of their own power. There's a conceit and an arrogance that comes with military authority.
Sure.
Yeah, so, and if you look at a mega pastor of a mega church, they're very seldom humble dudes. So this is the arrogance of human institutions, the hubris of human institutions. This is not, you know, the average Joe, working for a living, is very seldom presumptive, arrogant, and conceited, at least to get a warning from Yahweh. So he's talking about the leaders of human institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Then he uses a very unusual word for crown, and we've been over this territory, and I'm not going to apologize for going back over it, because A, that's how we learn, and B, the transition from something that we have come to hear to something that we can actually use because we've come to understand it. It is through this process of very close examination and repetitively looking at it that makes that transition. Because the majority of the listeners to this show are not people who are religious. They're people who are not religious. Most are people who have accepted Yahweh's invitation to become part of his covenant family. And so we have a responsibility, and I mean that in a positive, lighthearted way,
sure,
but to educate and equip.
Sure.
And so that's why we're going back over this. So it says that the word for crown conveys several things, that it is equal parts crown in the sense of a symbol of human authority, you know, religious authority, political authority, military authority. And you say crown, military authority. Oh, all of the military leaders of us, oh, wore crowns. Yeah,
they got the little hats with their stuff on them.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And political, and you look at the religious leaders; they all have little hats with their stuff on. Right. Right. And so this is a round hat that's a symbol of authority.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also the wreath of victory.
Right.
And so it's all of the athletic, I got my ring, I'm fighting for my ring. We're all in it for the ring, in American sports. It's fighting for that wreath that was given to the victor. And the wreath wasn't just to the victor in athletic competition, but it was the same wreath that was given to the victor in military encounters.
Caesar.
Right. Caesar with his wreath. Exactly. That's what they wore. It was a wreath. And the wreath was shaped as it was to be a symbol of the sun, and so they were being so deified as children of the sun.
Right.
That is what's being conveyed here. But also, this word for wreath, Atarah, is specifically designed to speak of encircling and being a circle.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to analyze the word of what things grew out of the concept of circle. And what's the most famous thing in the world today that is named after the root of circle?
Church.
Church, yeah. It's named after the daughter of the sun, Church, who was depicted as a circle, and Church, his name became the basis of the English word for circuit, for circus, and for circle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the basis of the English word for church. And so this is the crown, the authority of the church is what God is talking about here. And it's integration with political authority. What did the Roman Catholic Church do at its impetus with Theodosius when he imposed Christianity as the official religion of Rome? What two titles did he take, and how did he incorporate the religion of Christianity into the politic of Rome?
Well, he became besides he was the emperor, he was also the pope.
Pope. That is correct. Yeah. That is correct. Keeping in Roman tradition, starting with Augustus, Caesar Augustus, Octavian, who became Caesar Augustus, he became the first pope and the first emperor who was deified as the son of the sun.
Yeah.
And so he was the pope or father of the country, as well as the living embodiment of the sun, as well as being head of the military, as well as being head of the political infrastructure of the country, an absolute dictator. This is an integration of these things. That's why this word for crown was chosen. And that's what the Roman Catholic Church did.
Mm-hmm.
It imposed this integration of cleric and king to suppress the people, to enrich the cleric and king, to give them more control. And they did it and perpetrated it for 1,000 years. I would say that's a significant enough event to encourage a woe. There is another aspect of Atarah that we considered in our previous programs, Kirk, which is that Paul claimed a crown for himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that those who had joined his church afforded him a crown, that they were his crown. And so we have an individual here, and you know, I don't want to sound like I'm being contradictory in saying that woes aren't for individual sins, therefore institutionalized rebellion against God, religious, political, military.
But he becomes an institution.
That is
like
correct.
Like Hitler to Nazism, I mean.
That is correct.
They're synonymous.
Yeah, they are correct. That is absolutely the case. He is the basis of Christianity. There is no religion of Christianity without Paul. He's not just the author of half the Christian New Testament. He is the basis
author
of the church.
Of
there is no church without him. There is no Christianity without him. You speak about arrogance, though. The religion that grew out of his letters, the Roman Catholic Church, claiming to have the keys to heaven and to being the vicar of Christ on earth. Presumptuous, arrogant, and conceited. Yeah. Yeah, it's just like Paul claiming that that God had authorized him and him alone to be the one witness and spokesperson to the world. Presumptive, arrogant, conceited. All out of the same cloth. That's what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so it says, woe to the presumptive, arrogant, and conceited crown. And it goes on to say, of the intoxicated of Ephraim. And it's going to use intoxicated again here in just a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why intoxicated?
Well, we get drunk on ourselves, you know.
We do.
Drunk on ideas. We certainly.
Yep.
So there's a metaphor besides just being drunk by wine.
Yep. We are also living at a time where And people have been in this for a long time, but people are intoxicated. I mean, if you look at civilization, civilization grew out of being able to brew beer and wine because otherwise the water would kill you. And people didn't know that you had to boil the water to rid it of the pathogens and the little creepy crawlies. But the alcohol and beer and wine resolved that. And, you know, so beer and wine made civilization possible, so people were inebriated, and today, well, we have an entirely inebriated
million
generation.
Ways to be distracted, yes.
Right, a million ways to be drugged today, and so I think he's talking about absolute drugs,
mm-hmm.
Including alcohol. But that's not the main gist of it. Being intoxicated with since spirits have always been part of it, because of alcohol being both a gas and a liquid. You know, it's something that you can feel in your eyes and smell with your nose. It's alcohol is right there at the cusp of always being a gas and a liquid. And so there's always been this association between alcohol and spirits.
Mm-hmm.
And so alcohol is very often a symbol throughout the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms of the wrong spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the spirit of the demons, the spirit of deceit, the spirit of Satan and his influence of the adversary.
And can't get more rebellious than that.
Right. And so these people are intoxicated with demonic influence. And then he says of Ephraim, and we considered all the reasons in previous programs of why he said of Ephraim as opposed to any other name he could have put there.
Yeah, because he's symbolic of northern tribes of Israel.
Right, who were in outright rebellion against him. And what was their rebellion?
Other gods.
Yeah, religious, wasn't it?
Walk away religious, yeah.
Yeah. In fact, Yahweh's entire indictment against Ephraim was religious and rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
That they were religious. He sought a relationship, the covenant, and they sought to be religious, and that's why he divorced himself of them. So Ephraim is the living embodiment of religion.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he uses Ephraim here.
He's the living embodiment of us.
Of what we've become.
Yeah.
Yeah, of humanity and at large.
All those parallels, and all through Europe and all through the empires and all through our current empire.
Yeah. You'd have to say that mankind is about 90% religious, particularly if you look at how we have created religious symbolism and religious texts for socialist secular humanism and political correctness as moral code.
Right, and patriotism. Combine all of them and you just get a sick, boy, what a mess of Babel that is.
Yeah, it's a complete intoxicating mix of Babel. In fact, you know, it's amazing how those who engage in the military become intoxicated by it. They become intoxicated by the power. They become intoxicated by the patriotic myths. They become intoxicated that they're justified in killing.
Oh, yeah.
So, this is...
I know him. I've hired him. I've been friends to him. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So this is a very common circumstance here. And so here we are. That's why he chose Ephraim. Conceited crown or authority of the intoxicated of Ephraim. So he is speaking to those who are religious. Ephraim is synonymous with a religious rebellion against God.
Mm-hmm.
So the warning is to those who are religious, those who are intoxicated with the wrong spirit, those whose judgment has been impaired by the wrong spirit, and to the leaders of those organizations who are presumptive, arrogant, and conceited. So then he says, so then the flowers, beauty, desirability, and honor foolishly fade away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason he's taking this approach, and listen, sometimes Yahweh is just blunt, right in your face. And sometimes he is subtle. And sometimes he waxes poetic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he does it because the different things appeal to different people. Different things, different approaches resonate differently with people. And so if you use a combination of just blunt, you know, don't make a habit of killing. It's pretty blunt. You know, don't make a habit of adultery. which has very little to do with individual marriage, because in Yahweh's Torah, all a man or a woman have to do to get a divorce is to write down, I want a divorce.
Yeah.
That's all they have to do. So he's talking about the very reason that he condemned Ephraim. He says, you're unfaithful. You know, you're whores. You're prostitutes. You're engaged in adultery. The adultery he's talking about is religious adultery. Being religious. Yah views as being adulterous. So he's telling us here that this bloom, the attractive part and the reproductive part of the plant, the part of the plant which flourishes and shines and shimmers, that's that desirability, the beauty of that aspect of Ephraim is fading away. And to use poetic language like this, he's creating a visual picture. So there was something about Ephraim that was once beautiful. And didn't Ephraim, one of the, you know, it's 10 of the 12 tribes, and because Benjamin sided with him, it's really 11 of the 12.
Yeah, he got the big blessing over his brother, the older brother.
Correct.
So he was a big deal.
Right. So the covenant is a family, and it talks about the children of the covenant producing, you know, more children to be part of the covenant.
Well, that was his blessing, to be fruitful. He was a multitude of people. I mean, it's not a small little group of Jews somewhere.
Yeah.
This is a big group of people.
Yeah, and Yahweh said to Ephraim and Hoshea, you are not my children.
Mm-hmm.
So they're no longer
associated at all.
Yeah, productive in that way. So they were productive. They're no longer productive.
Now, as a little aside here on that word for flowers, also a secondary meaning, or another meaning, is the shining plate on the forehead of a high priest, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
Because
it is.
Yeah. Identify him even further as he once was a big deal.
Right.
So it's shining as well, so that's a good translation you have there.
Yeah.
And then
go ahead.
Sorry. No, I was going to say, and then when it is paired with a fading, like a fading flower, then you have, it's withered, of course, and faded, but it also is a translation for a man who falls down or like a fallen leaf off the tree.
Sure.
So it's separated, it falls down, it's cast down, it's left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A flower that has fallen. You know, when the beauty, this was a vigorous, flourishing plant from a symbolic point of view, Ephraim, representing either 10 or 11 of the 12 tribes, and therefore it was part of of Yahweh's chosen people, and flourishing and beautiful and attractive and producing the children of the covenant. He's saying all that's gone.
Mm-hmm.
All that's gone. And if you're part of the covenant family, you're gleaming, you're sparkling.
You're sure you're light.
Right, you're light. Yeah. And so all of that, he's saying, all the desirability and the beauty of all of that, the growth associated with that, the glory, the splendor, the prominence, the attractiveness, the appeal of all of that is all gone. You squandered it, which means you once had it, and you gave it away.
All right. Very sad.
That's really sad.
Very sad.
And in a collective way. So the religious squandered all of these things. You know, you're not desirable. You have nothing that would make you attractive. And if you're not attractive to Yahweh, why would he want you as part of his family?
Yeah.
Foolishly fades away. You know, it's I think that's indicative of the nature of religion. Foolishly fades away. Very few of us make a decision where one moment we're not religious, the next moment we are religious. One moment we're not political, the next moment we are political.
No, it's a growth.
It's a gradual thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It was for me.
Yeah. So it just foolishly fades away. And it's not just fades away, which talks about an ongoing separation from Yahweh and an ongoing cleaving to institutions, political and religious and military institutions and national and patriotic institutions, but it's a result of being foolish.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, for me to change, if you present me something and say this is wrong, and my second question is, well, what is something to go to? I didn't like to just change things just to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, mm-hmm. is there something to be salvaged in what I'm doing, or is there something better to go to? I mean, right. That was my thing against the hippies. I mean, it's fine to tear everything down. What are you going to replace it with?
Correct.
And,
it's fine to know, for example, that Islam is rotten to the core.
Yeah.
It's fine to know that Pauline Christianity is rotten to the core. But unless you know where you're going
point
to,
point me in the right direction, or don't help me.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with somebody that just says Christianity's false,
yeah.
Islam is false, socialist secular humanism is almost always incorrect because it's based on political correctness, which is universally invalid.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to say that. I don't have an issue with saying that. I don't have an issue with the hippies saying that that authority, human authority, political, military authority, religious authority is corrupt, and we don't want to be associated anymore. All good?
I understood that.
All good.
But if I join your group, where are we going?
But their group, you can't join their group because
they have
an adversity to those things.
And that's not helpful to me.
Well, it is.
It is in the sense that get out of the way of trouble. I mean, get away
right,
from
that. Right. Yeah. Stop swearing your allegiance to something that is corrupt, that is counterproductive, that is destructive. You know, our military is counterproductive. It's destructive. Our political leadership is counterproductive. It's destructive. Religious institutions are universally counterproductive. They're destructive. So I think it's good to that point. But
Y'all always says walk away from too.
Right. That's
you turn,
it, yes.
You turn
what's the two?
From, it's not repent. It's turn from
right.
to walk
right.
with me.
Right. For example, you walk away from politics to religion, you haven't accomplished anything. If you walk away from religion to politics, you haven't accomplished anything. If you walk away from an impoverished life to the military, you know you're
and
going. It's counterproductive. It's a waste of time.
No help in academia either. You don't run off and say, okay, I'll just be a teacher. You know, at the end of Vietnam, because that was the period when I was taking educational courses, as well as art degrees, and there was an influx of a tremendous amount of Vietnam veterans
mm-hmm.
that became teachers because they wanted to do something that was not tied in. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So there was a big jump there. I mean, so that's walking away from. But if you're just going to go to academia and learn Dewey's progressive education program, which ruined us, that is socialist secular humanism, where it's taught the philosopher of it. I mean, gosh, or a philosopher of it,
mm-hmm.
not the, but a one of. What did you gain by going there? You thought you were going to do something wonderful, and then you wind up being part of the problem.
Right. Yeah, you're part of those that are indoctrinating each other so that they cease to think,
cease
to be judgmental. They don't exercise good judgment. They're no longer discerning, and so you've dumbed down a generation. It's kind of like taking drugs or alcohol,
mm-hmm.
being intoxicated where you've rendered your ability to exercise good judgment moot. That's the whole idea of being intoxicated. What's more intoxicating than political correctness, where you dull your judgment?
Nothing.
You're it's
all
the same, right?
All on par.
Yeah, is exactly what's happening here. That's why it's speaking of foolishly fading away.
Mm-hmm.
And it speaks of that which was beneficially, by way of the relationship, a valley of olives,
mm-hmm.
first and foremost.
Nourishing as well as healing.
Right. Yeah, this was a channel. Ephraim was a river of olives based upon the beneficial nature of the relationship. And you need to think, so what is a river, a channel for the flow of olives? So we have to look at all of the things that are associated with olives.
Yeah, well, water is cleansing, but your flow of the olive is light.
Yeah, in fact, the olive is an ointment that you put on a wound
mm-hmm.
because it's not only will help clean the wound, but it'll help protect the skin and creates an environment where the wound will heal itself. So
our
it was very, very effective from a wound protection. So it's healing. It's also nourishing. Olive oil is an extremely nourishing thing to consume.
Much better to cook with as well.
Yeah, exactly. It was the purest form of light in the ancient world to burn olive oil. So it was a source of light and enlightenment. And then Yahweh used the olive and the oil of the olive for a concept that is known as anointing, but it's of designating someone and setting them apart.
Mm-hmm.
And saying, this person now is prepared to for service.
Yeah.
That was
right.
The concept of the olive. And the light and cleansing and nurturing aspect of the olive is always associated with the set-apart spirit, because it was the olive oil lamp and the olive oil and the menorah that creates light, that's enlightening. So this was a valley, a conduit for the spirit and for all of the things that were so essential. You know, what is, in the Middle East, the longest-lived tree?
I'm assuming it's the olive tree.
It is the olive, the longest-lived tree. It's a source of life, long life.
Yeah.
And they were conduit for all of these things as a result of the relationship. But it would be for naught, because all of those things were overcome and struck down. They were halam, broken, trampled upon. Recognizing that they were halam based on halal, which is Satan's name.
Yeah.
And they were struck down here with intoxication. So here, playing off intoxication again, being mentally and spiritually impaired, having your judgment rendered suspect, your ability to respond slowed and degraded. He says it's because of this intoxication and the arrogance and the presumptiveness of the religious and political and military leaders that Ephraim had lost its attractiveness. It was no longer productive, no longer flourishing, no longer appealing. There's the reason that he mentions intoxication twice. It is the intoxication that caused Ephraim to cease being a conduit for the things associated with the spirit. So God's being pretty clear here.
Yeah,
you know, it would not have used intoxication twice.
No,
if he wasn't saying it's an inebriating spirit.
Yeah.
That is causing
a lot of the meanings are overlapping on some of these words too. So when you go through all the different meanings of each one of them, so it's, yeah, he's being very clear. You can't miss the point.
Yeah, which one's overcome and struck down, which is halam, or yayin, which is with intoxication.
Mm-hmm.
Which of those words do you think that adds a depth that we haven't fully covered?
Well, it's not so much that. It's just I've noticed I was doing 28.1 and 28.2,
uh-huh.
And I don't mean to sound that he's being redundant, but, I mean, he does do a lot of the same thing, like the tempest and the storm and so forth that we're going to get to on the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And then he uses... it's just it, in English it would seem like overkill, but if you say he's the fading flower, and then he has beauty here, and then he has glorious here, which are different words. But then when you go through, so it's not you have to look them, each one of them up. I guess is
right.
What I'm telling the
audience. Let me give you a great example.
You have some, yeah.
Let's give you an example. Every one of the English Bibles translates Shakur and Yain as drunkenness.
Mm-hmm.
But why would he use two different words if he wanted both words rendered drunkenness?
Right.
And so you have to look at Shakur and Yain and say, how do these words differ? What are the shadings of these words that needs to come into play to properly convey what God is communicating by having chosen the two words? So you look at Shakur, that which is associated with the inebriated and drunkards, for those whose reasoning and judgment have been affected by the consumption of an intoxicating beverage, causing them to stumble away and to be forgetful and forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when I look at Shakur, the thing that screams out at me is or. Or is the Hebrew word for light.
Mm-hmm.
This is an inebriating light, you know, Hasatan.
Yeah, inebriating, that's very well put.
Right? Because he even uses a derivative of Halal's name in the in this context. So he's going out of his way to say this is the false light that is religious counterfeits, Christianity, Islam, Rabbinic Judaism,
mm-hmm.
Shakur. So it's affecting your judgment.
Right. But then, like you said, the wreath or the lower wreath up here, and then mm-hmm. the symbol of authority and the symbol of leadership, and then down here he uses a flower.
Right.
And that may seem very simple, but when you look it up and you see it's a shining plate on the head of a high priest, it's still talking about a,
right.
you know.
Right. Because the crown is never good. Right. Yeah, the crown is never good. Yahweh was never talking about us having a crown in a sense of a good thing. And so the crown is not good, but the flower is something that was good, that had positive characteristics that have all been wiped away by the intoxication of and the religious nature of Ephraim.
So you can't miss the point. And the beauty of, I guess I'm giving you a little mm-hmm. plug here, because I look up so much that you translate, is that there's so much shading in there. I mean, and you're giving
right.
them all the stuff. So that's why it's hard to go to a typical Bible, choice of words, and try to get all your information there. You have to look this stuff up.
You do. You need an amplified definition of each word so that you can see the differences in these words and the shadings and the nuances and the insights. Like, for example, the flower. Well, we've talked about it. It's the attractive part of the plant, the reproductive part of the plant that no longer is functioning, the part of the plant that enables the plant to flourish, to shine as a result of an engraved inscription. It's T-S-Y-T-S. It's the signpost that Yahweh's own hand represents on the way. Coming and going. T-S-Y-T-S. The sign that Yahweh, with his own hand, is placed on the way.